loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at several big stories, and it's Friday, so we'll talk with Jacqueline Lookman of the Lookman Nation and our producer, Walter Smolarek, for a full hour in our new regular Friday segment called The Week in Review. We get into the G20 meeting in Argentina, Mark Lamont Hill's firing by CNN, a domestic workers' bill of rights, and much, much more.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is spending more than $1 billion in Puerto Rico to repair homes damaged by Hurricane Maria. But much of that money is going to contractors charging steep markups and overhead. The New York Times reports that some repairs are indeed being made, but at an astronomical cost. Next, seven men were found guilty yesterday of the murder of Honduran indigenous environmental activist Berta Cáceres, who was shot and killed on March 2, 2016, 2 days before her 45th birthday. Cáceres had waged a long battle to stop construction of an internationally financed hydroelectric dam on the Gualcarque River, which the Lenca people consider sacred. The judge found that the murder was ordered by the construction company's executives. Then, Manor Care was a highly respected nursing home and retirement community company based in Silver Spring, Maryland. 5 years ago, it was taken over by the Carlyle Group, one of the largest private equity firms in the world. Under Carlyle's ownership, however, the company went bankrupt, and serious cases of elder abuse are now coming to light. And then the political news website Politico this week published an article about the foreign press and their apparent love affair with Donald Trump. The thrust of the article was that the foreign press doesn't criticize the president because fawning coverage is a way for countries to ingratiate themselves with him. But the article focuses on, of course, the Russians. It makes no mention of the Israeli press or news outlets in most Arab countries. And finally, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week. And in other headlines, at least 18 Palestinians were wounded by Israeli gunfire today on the Gaza border, 1 day after the 40th International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. At least 235 Palestinians have been killed on the Gaza border since March in the Great March of Returns Friday protests. Most have been killed by Israeli fire and some by airstrikes. Marriott International announced today that its Starwood Hotels and Resorts database has been hacked. Over a four-year period starting in 2014, Marriott estimates that up to 500 million guests' information may have been hacked. Personal information like name, address, email address, passport number, and credit card information may have been included in the breach. March 5th is the tentative new date for the sentencing hearing of President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort. A U.S. District Court judge set the date today for sentencing on his charges of one count of conspiracy and one count of obstruction of justice. This week, Special Counsel Mueller's team accused Manafort of breaking his plea deal by lying to Mueller, and the judge has given Manafort's defense team until December 7th to respond. Mueller's team has said that it is not yet clear whether they will now press additional charges. The Environmental Protection Agency's Inspector General announced that he had failed to determine who leaked details of Scott Pruitt's travel records for a December 2017 trip to Morocco. Pruitt faced multiple scandals during his tenure for abusing public resources and making exorbitantly expensive personal arrangements. Pruitt left office earlier this year and was replaced by acting EPA Administrator Andrew R. Wheeler. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the big stories this week. This is our new segment called The Week in Review. We talk about the week in politics, policy, and international and domestic affairs with Jacqueline Lookman and Walter Smolarek. Jackie is the co-editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. Walter Smolarek is a Sputnik News analyst and the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Jackie, Walter, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
Happy to be here.
A lot of stories. Of course, right now, this is Friday. The G20 is starting in Argentina. There's been a lot of talk, Walter, about this meeting because, of course, President Trump is meeting with the Chinese President Xi Jinping. And the question is, does the Cold War and the trade war accelerate or will they broker some kind of a deal? I noticed on the front page of the Wall Street Journal that the indications are, at least from the journal, that there might be a deal.
It's possible, although I think that sort of the underlying tensions aren't going to go away regardless of whether or not there's sort of a momentary detente. In trade relations, I mean, the tactic of the tariff, I mean, it's important to sort of separate out the different issues, I think, when it comes to U.S.-China relations and U.S.-China economic relations. Like, there's the tactic of tariffs, placing tariffs on imports from China, which is controversial even in elite circles, right? It's not just among the general population, because people might have to pay more for goods, or, you know, because jobs related to importing might go away. It's also controversial in elite circles because it kind of goes against the general quote-unquote neoliberal architecture of world trade that's been implemented really, you know, since the end of World War II, for the most part, where, you know, subsidies and tariffs are sort of frowned upon and progressively taken away. So perhaps they could reach an agreement whereby the United States doesn't use the tactic of tariffs as much as it has in the past. But I think underlying the underlying strategy of containing China and preventing its economic rise through things like intellectual property lawsuits, right? Making sure that China can introduce the latest technology and production techniques into their economy, making sure that China can't, create global trade networks by sabotaging the Belt and Road Initiative. I don't think there's any chance that U.S. hostility towards those types of big picture projects are going to go away, no matter what's agreed to at the G20.
Jackie, the Obama administration in 2011 in Australia, President Obama announced the Asia pivot. Now, I took that to mean at that point that he was making a geostrategic reorientation of U.S. military and foreign policy, not wanting to be bogged down in endless wars in the Middle East while China developed and became more and more influential, not just in Asia, but throughout the world. And the Asia pivot, as it was constructed at that time, had two pillars. One was economic, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's failed. And the second was to redeploy American military forces towards Asia, towards China, such that by the year 2020, 60% of all U.S. naval assets and 20% of all U.S. Air Force assets would be in the Asia-Pacific region. It seems to me that Walter's right here, Jackie, that even if there's an agreement, it's a tactical or a momentary agreement, the big picture is the trajectory of U.S. policy, which is actually targeting China. What do you think?
Yeah, no, that's actually, I think that's absolutely true, because we do see China having a bigger military footprint in regions around the world, especially in Africa. And they're really just doing it to directly challenge growing and spreading U.S. imperialism. And that conflict, that is not going to change between the U.S. and China, because especially with China now aligning militarily with Russia and other anti-imperialist kind of nations, especially militarily, that's not going to be brokered in any kind of trade deal that comes out of the G20. And I think also whatever is agreed to as far as tariffs or trade is concerned, It's not going to matter what the fine details are to Trump's base. I mean, they really are just going to see him coming out of the G20 with any kind of deal with China as being a victory for him, for being a tough talker and getting what he wants. So nothing really changes other than we pay more for things that come from China.
I want to move on to other stories, but before we do, Walter, I want to stay with this. The G20, we don't know what exactly will happen because it's Friday and the weekend of the G20 meeting is just beginning. I was struck by the recent Foreign Affairs magazine that devoted an entire issue to this G20 meeting and particularly to U.S.-Chinese relations. And there was a little bit of a debate, but I'm looking at an article by Eli Ratner. This is one of the submissions. He was a senior official or a semi-senior official in the Obama administration. The headline is, "There is no grand bargain with China. Why Trump and Xi can't meet each other halfway." I mean, it's quite amazing.
Yeah.
Like, no, there's no possible way that U.S. and China can have decent relations. Can't even meet halfway, which is like sort of the basis for—
Shouldn't even be talking about it.
Yeah. And I want to read a couple of sentences to you because I think it's very, very informative. It's not just Trump, who is bashing China in the 2016 campaign and has done so since he became president. This is one of the semi-senior officials from Obama. Here we go. In true showmanship fashion, U.S. President Donald Trump is keeping the world in suspense about whether he will soon double down on the United States trade war with China or call a truce. The big reveal will come after his meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping on the margins of the G20 in Buenos Aires later this week. Trump has at times been optimistic, telling reporters, quote, "I think a deal will be made. We'll find out very soon," close quote. Typical Trump. Okay. And then here's Eli Ratner. "Don't believe the hype. Any agreement in Argentina will be a tactical pause at best, providing short-term relief to jittery stock markets and beleaguered U.S. farmers, but having no material or long-lasting effect on the slide towards a high-stakes geopolitical competition between the United States and China. The days when the world's two largest economies could meet each other halfway have gone." Wow, that's very declarative. I mean, if they can't meet each other halfway, if there can't be normal, peaceful interaction, well, what's the option?
Then what?
What's the option?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the head of the U.S. military in Europe, who had just retired last year, he was speaking at a security conference in Poland just about a month or two ago. And he said that, well, you know, within 15 years, I think there's a pretty good chance that there's going to be a war both with Russia and with China. You know, the U.S., the Pentagon establishment is openly talking about the possibility of like serious, I mean, great power competition is the euphemism that's used now, but it's, you know, a short step, right? It's a small step to go from great power competition to great power confrontation and conflict in a way that would be just completely catastrophic for the whole world. So the fact that, you know, in Foreign Policy magazine or in these security summits or, you know, these think tank gatherings, the fact that people are, you know, people who were or are in positions of tremendous influence are talking this openly about something that would be, you know, maybe the worst thing to ever happen is shocking, to say the least.
Yeah. And I think it speaks to how precarious this situation with this particular president is. This is somebody who knows nothing about diplomacy, even if in the Obama administration, the diplomacy was, you know, on the surface. And there were still, you know, like you said, Brian, this buildup in military presence in the South Chinese Sea and all this antagonism and all this military resources that we are committing to containing China or making a statement toward them, even in the midst of nice sounding diplomacy. Trump doesn't even have that. He doesn't even bother with nice sounding diplomacy. So there's no veneer there for any possibility of a civil diplomatic deal to be made here. It's all blunt force. It's all bullying. And I think the people who are on the inside and live this every day have a better view on what's to come and probably much faster than we do. And it's not a positive view at all.
Jackie, I'd like to turn to the latest developments in the Mueller investigation. You know, yesterday was a day full of news related to this Trump Tower Moscow that never came to be. And apparently, Michael Cohen, the president's former personal attorney, told the Mueller team, after lying about this to Congress, that he had spoken to the president about giving a $50 million penthouse condo to Vladimir Putin as a way to try to ensure that the building was built. Whether or not that was true, I think we'll probably never know.
That's the guy Slater in Moscow, who was Cohen's connection. Who came up with the grand idea, let's give Putin a really expensive penthouse, and then everybody else will have to pay higher rents. And guess what? Guess what? Nothing came of it. Nothing came of it. There was no, this is just a hustler.
Which shows you how much Vladimir Putin wanted to try to control this narrative. But anyway, Cohen pleaded guilty yesterday to lying to Congress. And the lie was apparently came out of something that Donald Trump was truthful about in his interaction with Mueller, his written interaction. Cohen said to Congress that he had not spoken to Trump about this Moscow project after January of 2016. Trump said that they had spoken as late as June 2016. So then Cohen, caught in his lie, had to admit to Mueller, yeah, we spoke about it in June. It was after January. My bad. That's a felony. But it seems that there's nothing more to this than just this, really what turns out to be a little white lie.
I think there was a second lie.
Tell me.
It's even more minuscule than the first lie, which shows how they can catch you lying on anything. According to the Wall Street Journal accounts, people who have seen some of this, is that when he was before Congress, Michael Cohen told the investigators, the congressional investigators, that he had limited discussions with Donald Trump about the Moscow Project. And they weren't limited. They were fuller discussions.
That's preposterous. Think about this, too. Think about this. These are felony charges. So even though the sentencing guideline for these charges is 0 to 6 months, and for a first offense, it'll be zero with probably a year or 18 months of probation. This is a felony. You lose the right to vote. You lose the right to own a gun for the rest of your life. And you have this stigma of a felony conviction hanging over you. And for what? For something as ridiculous as this.
And there's a subpart of this lie. We have to really parse it to get down to how small and minuscule this is. The other part of that lie, though, was that when asked by congressional investigators back, you know, a year ago, Michael Cohen said he had not asked Trump whether he wanted to go to Moscow to pursue the Moscow Project during this is in 2016. And now Michael Cohen is saying, yes, he did ask Trump if he wanted to go to the Moscow to talk about the Moscow Project. So he lied to Congress when he said he didn't ask Trump, when in fact he did ask Trump. I mean, that's what the Mueller probe is coming down to.
And this is a lesson to all of us, that when you're asked a question like this by the FBI or by a special counsel or special prosecutor, you say, I don't recall. That's the lesson.
Or to the best of my memory or
that's
something.
To the best of my recollection. That's right.
This is such a ridiculous indictment on this whole Russiagate Mueller probe. And I mean that pun intentionally. It's a ridiculous indictment on this entire theater that they are making such a big deal. Mueller and the media and so many people who just are convinced that they're going to impeach Donald Trump because of this investigation, that these small kind of inconsequential lies are hyped up as much as they are over something that Trump has been openly trying to do, build Trump Tower in Russia for 30 years.
And don't you think the fact that the Russians never approved the deal? I mean, if the Russians wanted to approve the deal, if the Russian government wanted to approve the deal, it would have been approved.
Vladimir Putin has been a leader of Russia for 20 years. And there is indication that Trump did visit Russia and try to set up a meeting with Putin. And Putin didn't do it. He didn't want to. So all of that is left out of this entire discussion. And it's all focused on, oh, my God, this is the smoking gun. This is the smoking gun. This is going to prove collusion. No, it proves a desperate American businessman who has really bad business tactics, continually going after a crumbling market that at one time was emerging and is putting out feelers to all these powerful political people. But unfortunately, he got involved with a con man in Russia, just like he is. That's all this is. That's it.
Walter, I want to talk about the timing of the thing, because let's remember, Mueller was interviewing Michael Cohen a long time ago, and he spent a lot of time with him. I think they spent like 70 hours together, after which Mueller didn't try to indict Michael Cohen. What he did was he referred Cohen to the Southern District of New York for possible prosecution on corruption charges, financial crimes, etc. Mueller had no interest in Michael Cohen, presumably.
And in fact, the media made a big deal of that at the time, that it was a referral because it had nothing to do with this investigation.
Yeah, so there was no Mueller probe. Here we have, I want to ask about the question of the timing here. So Mueller says no big deal with Michael Cohen. In terms of the Russia probe. But now at the end of the day, at the moment that Trump is leaving for the G20, a surprise appearance by Michael Cohen in the court under the Mueller probe to plead guilty to these like minuscule lies again about the Moscow Project. And so that became the news yesterday. Trump, Michael Cohen, his personal lawyer, the Moscow Project, lies to Congress. In other words, it seems like a media stunt rather than an actual part of a serious probe regarding possible collusion between Russia and Trump.
Yeah, it reminds me of what happened just before the Helsinki summit between Trump and Putin, you know, the only sort of official summit that they've had, you know, not just meeting sort of on the sidelines of another event. And before the Helsinki summit, there is another, and this time it was multiple indictments. It was a wave of indictments targeting people who, you know, Mueller knew would never appear in a U.S. courtroom because they were not in the United States. They were Russian citizens who lived in Russia. So now basically they can't go to the U.S., but of course they'll never be any type of legal proceeding where they can defend themselves and present evidence and have, you know, like a fair hearing and due process. So, you know, it was purely a stunt. It was something that could never, you know, actually bring anybody to quote unquote justice. But it was time just before Trump went to the Helsinki summit. And I think that, you know, this might be a repeat of the same, you know, general tactical thinking to unleash this thing against Cohen, make the Moscow Project, you know, which I saw CNN was capitalizing like Moscow, capital M, Project, capital P, just before he goes to the G20.
Okay, in our last 5 minutes before we go to break, let's talk about the other part of this Russia story, which is Luke Harding's piece in The Guardian, and then all of the opposition to that article. Luke Harding, a couple days ago, John, said Paul Manafort, who's in solitary confinement right now, awaiting sentencing, met with Julian Assange, not once, not twice, but three times at the Ecuadorian embassy. This was breaking news because nobody knew about this.
Right. It was never documented in the visitor's book.
Yeah. We never knew about it because guess what?
Right.
It didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
It didn't happen. Paul Manafort, when the story came out, said this is 100% false. WikiLeaks actually bet $1 million with The Guardian that it's not true. Julian Assange and WikiLeaks also have said that they want to sue The Guardian.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day, as the story broke apart, fell apart, Politico has an article by a former CIA officer under a pen name, Alex Finley, who said, if Luke Harding, this great journalist and correspondent, got that story so wrong, if he did, it was because the Russians set him up. So the Russians are to blame for Assange. The Russians are to blame for Manafort. The Russians are to blame for the story about Manafort and Assange being actually untrue. I mean, the Russians can't win.
I mean, there's so many different components to it. There's the anti-Russia campaign. There's the campaign against alternative media and the intermingling of those two different political trends. WikiLeaks has done so much to expose all the misdeeds of the U.S. government. There is, you know, the collateral murder video, right, where it showed, you know, a U.S. helicopter team mowing down unarmed civilians who are posing no threats to anybody, including a journalist. It exposed, you know, all sorts of U.S. interference in other countries' relations or internal affairs and national sovereignty through the publication of the, you know, the diplomatic wires. You know, it's something that it's one of the few outlets that are doing, you know, real journalism in the sense that it challenges the power of the powerful. And so as sort of a subsidiary thing or really as a central part of the anti-Russia campaign, which has all these big geopolitical implications and motivations that we've been talking about, there's also this very, you know, it's very helpful for people in power, this campaign against alternative media outlets that are challenging them on the basis that they are either active participants in Russian, you know, the Russian campaign to undermine U.S. democracy, or, you know, just unwitting dupes who are parroting the Moscow line.
Well, John, let's talk here again about timing, about this Manafort met with Assange story, which
right.
appears to be complete fiction. Let's talk about the timing here, because there was a committee to protect journalists that were in court at the same week, this last week.
In the Eastern District of Virginia.
Trying to make the U.S. government come clean about whether it's going to indict this media outlet or has indicted this media outlet through a secret grand jury. They were there. That case was the judge didn't rule about whether the U.S. government would be compelled to talk about that. And boom, the story changes. Instead of the injustice against Julian Assange, it's like Paul Manafort and Julian Assange are best buds.
Right.
I mean, what about timing?
Right. The timing is everything here, too. We've seen now two nothing stories that had a day of screaming hair on fire headlines, right? This week, we've seen the Cohen issue that really had nothing behind it. It was a straw man. And we see this one. The stories get a day of coverage. There's nothing behind them. No other media outlets pick them up, and then they just go away. So to me, this isn't an issue of the Russians influencing the narrative. This is an issue of Robert Mueller or others, allies of Robert Mueller's, leaking information to the press to keep their narrative front and center.
When we come back from our break, I want to start with the idea that perhaps the government of Ukraine was also aware of timing. Trump was on his way to the G20, where he said he wanted to meet with Putin. Putin said he wanted to meet with him. And then this other incident happened in the Sea of Azov right before it, creating a new crisis. Ukraine announces martial law before an election, and now Trump has canceled the meeting. We're going to talk about that when we come back from the break.
So as recently as this morning, the Russian language press is reporting that that meeting is still on.
Stay with us. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll come right back with the big stories of the week.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
In this half hour, we continue our discussion of the big news stories of the week. We are talking about politics, policy, international affairs, domestic affairs inside the United States with Jacqueline Lookman and Walter Smolarek. Jacqueline is the co-editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. And Walter Smolarek is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Walter, before we went to break, we were starting to talk for a second. I only want to spend a minute of this on this topic, but it's an important one. What happened in the Sea of Azov this week? Ukraine has now declared martial law. The very unpopular Poroshenko, the president, has an approval rating of 8%. I don't know. I'm getting conspiratorial here, but again, what about timing?
What happened is that, you know, there's two bodies of water that are very important to both Ukraine and Russia. There's the Black Sea, and then there's the Sea of Azov. And there's a very, very small waterway that lets ships access the Sea of Azov from the Black Sea. It's called the Kerch Strait.
Kerch Straits.
And so, you know, there's been an arrangement between Ukraine and Russia about how to manage and govern the Kerch Strait since the conflict broke out in the country in 2014, where civil war broke out in Ukraine, because there's a very important Ukrainian port that's in, you know, in the Sea of Azov, by the Sea of Azov, that you have to go through this strait to get to. And so basically the arrangement, since Crimea, you know, had a referendum, affixed itself to Russia, that the Ukrainian vessels that would go through, you know, both commercial vessels and naval vessels, they would just have to follow basically a procedure, you know, a standard type of communication, so that, you know, they, the Russian authorities, the Russian Coast Guard that patrol the area, know that they don't have any type of hostile intent. So what happened apparently is that two Ukrainian frigates and a tugboat went through the Kerch Strait, but they didn't follow the standardized communication procedure that had been agreed upon and used for many years. So why would they have done that? And, you know, they were subsequently detained by the Russian Coast Guard.
I want to jump in because as these, and you can see this from, if people can go to a Moon Over Alabama website, you can watch a video. It's not the video you're going to see on BBC, but it's a fuller video. What actually happened is as these boats came through those very tiny, narrow Kerch Straits from the Black Sea to the Sea of Azov, they were told to stop, and they didn't stop. Instead, they took their covers off their gunships. They were told to stop again. Then the Russians, when they didn't stop, fired warning shots, and then they kept going. And finally, the Russians opened fire on them. A number of sailors were shot. About 24 or 25 of them were detained. And Walter, I think it's important to remember that this agreement for how to navigate from the Black Sea to the very shallow Sea of Azov, which is perhaps only 20 feet deep, so a lot of coordination inherently is necessary. This agreement has been in existence for not since 2014, but for many, many years. And up until this week, in spite of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine starting in 2014, before and since that conflict, these ships have gone through these narrow straits without incident. So some people are saying, well, Russia's now carrying out this act of aggression. Maybe, but then again, why would they? I mean, Putin is just about to go to the G20. What would be the incentive?
Well, I can't think of an incentive, but there's a very clear incentive for the Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko. And just so the listeners know who this guy is, so his nickname was the Chocolate King. He's an oligarch, right? He runs a country's candy monopoly. And he was sort of handpicked as a consequence or, you know, out of the chaos of the 2014 overthrow of the Yanukovych government. He rose to power and became the president of Ukraine. He's an intensely personally corrupt person, or is widely believed to be an intensely personally corrupt.
And intensely widely unpopular.
Right, exactly. And so there's an election coming up in March in Ukraine. And what was Poroshenko's very first response to this, you know, capture of three Ukrainian ships and sailors? His response was, we're going to declare martial law. And there are a couple provisions of martial law that are very, very convenient and helpful for Petro Poroshenko's political future. One is that elections cannot be held during the duration of martial law. So it was 60 days, right? And it can be extended. So the 60-day ban on elections, if it's renewed one more time, that'll bring the country right to the eve of the March election. So if he wants to, he could actually postpone this election that he's slated to lose.
Indefinitely, can he not?
Yeah, right. As long as the state of emergency is in effect. The other thing that a state of emergency or a situation of martial law allows Poroshenko to do is to ban public gatherings. That means that he can prohibit his opponents from campaigning, whereas him being the president during this, you know, grave national crisis that he's probably concocted, you know, he's of course getting all the attention. It's probably favorable attention. He's posturing as sort of the defender of the country's territorial integrity. And so even if he doesn't want to actually cancel or postpone indefinitely the election, he can greatly increase his chances of winning. Right now, he's polling in about third place. He's got, you know, like 7, 8, 9, 10% support in the polls. It's not looking very good for him. This could turn that around. And the person who is in first place is Yulia Tymoshenko. And this is where Poroshenko's background as an oligarch and widely believed to be corrupt comes into play. Because if Tymoshenko becomes the president, because of the bitter political rivalry, longstanding bitter political rivalry between the two, he could actually find himself in serious legal trouble as well. So this Kerch Strait crisis very, very clearly fits into the domestic political agenda of Petro Poroshenko.
Well, this is really interesting because there's so much behind this event that happened earlier this week that, of course, is not reported in the U.S. press. And there's so much history behind these two powers and all of these details about these leaders that people don't know. But because of all of this other smoke and mirror stuff with Russia and Trump and, you know, Manafort and Assange and Russia has stolen our elections, of course, it's easy to make Russia the bad guy in this case. And the facts just don't point to that. The facts really just point to another leader who does what a lot of American leaders, American presidents have done when they're sinking in the polls, to manufacture a crisis.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, it's kind of like the oldest trick in the book in terms of politics, like the rally around the flag effect. You know, if you have flagging popularity, what can you do? Well, you know, you can win a war.
Let's talk about another story. Again, it's in the media and it's about the media. And it's about censorship in the media. CNN fired a commentator, Mark Lamont Hill, on Thursday for expressing support for Palestinian freedom at the United Nations on Wednesday. I mean, he was speaking at the United Nations. Let's talk about Mark Lamont Hill, what he said, and why he got fired. Go ahead, Jackie.
So Mark Lamont Hill was speaking at the UN and expressing clear solidarity with the Palestinian people. And he was speaking from the experiences of Black people in our struggle for liberation and how that struggle is connected with the Palestinian struggle. He said, as a Black American, my understanding of action and solidarity action is rooted in our own tradition of struggle. As Black Americans resisted slavery, as well as Jim Crow laws that transformed us from a slave state to an apartheid state, we did so through multiple tactics and strategies. It is this array of tactics that I appeal to as I advocate for concrete actions from all of us in this room. So he's sitting at the UN and he's talking about all of the, he's connecting all of the different ways that Black Americans have used, all the different strategies we've used to push this liberation struggle for our people in this country, and compared it to the kind of different strategies and tactics that world leaders need to employ, along with the Palestinian people and those people in Israel who are sympathetic to Palestinian liberation, have to employ to change that situation in Palestine.
What happened to Mark Lamont Hill, Walter and John, it seems to me it sort of helps us focus in like a laser on the real problem in the way the U.S. media handles the issue of Israel or the issue of the Palestinians. And here's why. We know that there have been peaceful Palestinian protests in the last few months on Fridays, right? The Great March of Return. And thousands of people have been shot by Israeli snipers. Israeli political leaders have gone on multiple media outlets to defend their use of violence, right? They're defending their use of violence against even peaceful protesters. Now, Mark Lamont Hill said, and had the gall to say to the UN, contrary to Western mythology, black resistance to American apartheid did not come purely through Gandhi and nonviolence. Rather, slave revolts and self-defense and tactics otherwise divergent from Dr. King or Mahatma Gandhi were equally important to preserving safety and attaining freedom. Now, that's a historically accurate rendition of what happened.
Those are historical facts. That's not an opinion.
And so then the CNN fires him because he's suggesting that the people living under occupation have the right to do something other than simply to peacefully protest and be shot at, that there might be civil disobedience. There could even be armed resistance. In other words, it's a historically accurate rendition of almost all liberation struggles of people who are fighting under colonial occupation. But that means in the U.S. media, see, you're advocating violence against Israel. And Mark Lamont Hill was not doing that. He was making a point that the Palestinians cannot be completely delegitimized if by chance at some points the Palestinians, like the Israelis, also resort to violence.
Right. And, you know, the Israelis, the violence that's being carried out by Israeli forces against the Great March of Return in the Gaza Strip, you know, it's targeting protesters. It's also targeting medics, right? People who are trying to assist the wounded. It's also targeting journalists who are wearing big flak jackets with press printed across. I mean, it's such an absolutely 100% crystal clear massacre of civilians, and it's taking place not just at one time, although there were, you know, particular incidents that were especially horrible, like what happened on Nakba Day on May 15th, I believe, where, you know, 60 people were gunned down, thousands were shot, 60 people were killed, Palestinians. But it's happening every single week. And the fact that, you know, that tremendous violence that's actually concrete and specific and real and going on is not really the issue, right? You can go ahead and defend that and, you know, not lose your positions either in the media or your job or suffer any consequences whatsoever. In fact, it's probably good for your career if you're a defender of that type of violence. But for Mark Lamont Hill to not actually advocate violence, but to just, you know, historically recall that, like, hey, you know, this is kind of what an anti-colonial struggle historically looks like. That's something that's this big national scandal and causes him to be kicked off CNN is so absurd. And the other thing is that this shows how, you know, the attack line against Palestinians, the anti-Palestine campaign, anti-Palestinian solidarity campaign, is really an attack on all progressive people, because Mark Lamont Hill, although, you know, the issue of Palestine is very central to his beliefs, of course, he has a whole wide range of commentary and views and activism on other issues that are of critical importance against police brutality, against mass incarceration, for the freedom of political prisoners, for, you know, the rights of poor and working people to live, you know, materially decent lives. You know, all of that there's an attempt to silence all of that under the banner of this anti-Palestine campaign.
John, I think when I read Mark Lamont Hill's statement at the UN, it's downright eloquent.
It's
courageous, it's brave, and it's honest. He says, if we are standing in solidarity with the Palestinian people, we must recognize the right of an occupied people to defend itself. We must prioritize peace, but we must not romanticize or fetishize it. I think that's extremely important.
I agree.
We must advocate and promote nonviolence at every opportunity, but we cannot endorse a narrow politics of respectability that shames Palestinians for resisting, for refusing to do nothing in the face of state violence and ethnic cleansing. You know, I could reach into my pocket right now and pull out dollar bills, and they have on them the, quote, father of this country, George Washington. He led an armed resistance against the British colonialism. Yeah. Why is it that if the Palestinians do something other than be shot at, that they then are the perpetrators of violence? And why, if somebody like Mark Lamont Hill eloquently explains the real dynamics, that he too must be censored and brought down from the U.S. media? Amazing.
I agree. And, you know, he tied this all together at the end. And as you say, Brian, the word really is eloquent, or eloquence. That's really what he was. He says here, we must struggle together in order to resist, because state violence in the United States and state violence in Brazil and state violence in Syria and state violence in Egypt and state violence in South Africa and state violence in Palestine are all of the same sort. And we finally understood that we must work together and not turn on each other, but instead turn to each other. I think that's truly eloquent, and I don't know how anybody could disagree with a statement like that. Let me add one other thing. When I was working at the CIA, I used to work weekends a lot for overtime, and I reported to my colleagues on Monday morning that there had been a bus bombing somewhere, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, whatever it was, and two Israelis were killed. And after I reported this, the Sri Lanka analyst came up to me, and he said, "So two Israelis were killed in this bus bombing, huh?" And I said, "Yeah, they were." And he said, "Did you know that 36 Sri Lankans were killed in violence this weekend? But nobody cares about them." Well, it's the same exact situation in Palestine, where we've become so used to the narrative that it's only the Israeli lives that matter. And that narrative is reinforced by all of our major media outlets, that we forget until we hear somebody like Mark Lamont Hill tell us what real human rights are about. And then we have those same media outlets objecting to it.
Exactly. It's really, I think it's a perfect case. I think people should let CNN know how you feel about the censoring of Mark Lamont Hill, eloquent voice, because he dared to tell the truth, not on air, but as a private person at the United Nations, mm-hmm. at a conference. Disgusting censorship. Let's go on. I want to do one more international story. Time is going fast. But the GOP-controlled Senate passed a vote on Yemen this week. 63 to 37. 63 to 37. What did they do, John?
Yeah, this was a dramatic vote. Now, the Senate's rules are quite complicated. So this vote, the 63 to 37 vote, was to allow for a vote on the floor of the Senate to restrict the president's war powers in order to make war, to continue making war in Yemen. So what this vote would do, and I should preface this by saying that Paul Ryan in the House said that the House will not consider a similar measure. So this was symbolic. But what it would do would be to force the president to submit to Congress any military activity that he wants to fund in Yemen. So that would be the refueling of Saudi and Emirati bombers and fighter jets. It would be for money for special forces on the ground in Yemen, which we have special forces on the ground in Yemen, despite the Pentagon's denials. Everything would have to be approved under a war powers resolution. And this president hasn't done that. So, as I said, it's symbolic, but it's a major step forward. It's funny, Brian, that that a vote is taken on Capitol Hill, and the most positive reporting that you see is in places like Consortium News and Common Dreams and Revolution News and outlets like that, because it's just so out of the ordinary and so out of character for this Republican-controlled Senate.
Yeah. Walter, what about the Yemen vote? Is it symbolic? Is it real? Is it significant? Is there going to be a possible change in U.S. policy?
Well, it's significant, but I think it is, you know, largely symbolic. You know, the Pentagon is in charge of what happens on the ground there. And, you know, I think that even they've even shown that they're willing to buck the presidency itself sometimes. So I don't think that a resolution or a vote to have a vote from the Senate will necessarily deter them. But I think it does. It is positive in the sense that it adds to the political pressure and it adds to the sort of changing tide of public opinion about, you know, the nature of the war in Yemen. One, that it sort of helps lift the blackout on the conflict, which had been pretty firmly enforced by the mainstream media up until the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. You know, at that point, it became sort of okay to criticize the Saudis, and then the war in Yemen became sort of a subsidiary issue. You know, so it's helping to lift the blockade, the media blackout. And it's also, I think, you know, maybe pushing the situation to a point where there can be some kind of negotiated solutions or a serious attempt to have a negotiated solution. The UN envoy, the UN peace envoy to Yemen, he traveled to Sana'a not too long ago to talk to the Houthi rebels who control the north of the country to try to set something like that up. So it's important. I was very happy to see it happen. There are all sorts of different calculations and senators voting for different reasons behind it. But yeah, I think we should welcome this development.
We're joined by Jacqueline Lookman from the Lookman Nation and Walter Smolarek. We're talking, as we do every Friday now, in this segment called The Week in Review. Let's turn to another really, really important story. There are millions of people in the United States who are domestic workers. The role of domestic workers as part of the U.S. working class is, in fact, substantially growing because numerically that part of the workforce is growing. Jackie, a Bill of Rights for domestic workers. Talk about it.
I mean, this is actually really, really exciting because I think people forget that all workers, all kinds of workers are not included in the workers' protection legislation like the National Labor Relations Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, and even the Civil Rights Act. Those legislations left out certain classes of workers, and domestic workers was one of those classes of people. That's really important because domestic workers not having legislative protections on the workforce, have left them without advocating for minimum wage. They don't get paid for overtime. They don't have collective bargaining protections. Their domestic workers are notoriously more subjected to sexual harassment and no protection against sexual harassment and no recourse when they are attacked in that way. So this Bill of Rights being introduced is really, really important for the 45% of domestic workers who are undocumented and immigrants, but also for the 55% of American domestic workers who have never been covered by any labor related law since the 1930s. So now this, I think the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights is a great example of the solidarity in the labor movement that has to happen between American workers and immigrant workers, because now we're seeing this resurgence of this wedge issue of demonizing immigrants as a threat to American jobs. But the symbiosis of American workers and immigrant workers in the domestic field and their work together in bringing about this Domestic Workers Bill of Rights is exactly the kind of labor solidarity that we saw throughout history that has resurged now. And it's so timely and it's so needed, not just for domestic workers. I mean, this is life changing for them. But it's also so timely for labor, the labor movement in America and the immigrant movement in America. We have to have more examples of this kind of solidarity between American workers and immigrant workers, because it's worker solidarity that's going to break the back of capitalist abuse. And I think this is one great example of how that's going to happen.
That's the voice of Jacqueline Lookman. We're also joined by Walter Smolarek here in this segment on Loud and Clear called The Week in Review. The clock is ticking down, John. I want to stay with the issue of U.S. workers, but another sector of U.S. workers. This is a story we talked about with UAW official Neil Sweeney earlier this week. General Motors, in spite of the fact that it gets large amount of subsidies, was bailed out, had its collective bargaining agreements restructured under the Obama administration, just announced they're going to lay off a huge part of the workforce. And this includes in Michigan, it's in Ohio, and also in Ontario, Canada, 15,000 families, many of them older workers who are going to be without work. And Donald Trump is angry, and of course, not as angry as the workers who are affected, but he said, I support the American workers. He threatened subsidies would be retracted from General Motors. And when we were talking to Neil Sweeney, we made the point, Look, if Donald Trump is saying, I support the American workers, if he's rallying against GM for laying off these people, if GM is in fact getting taxpayers' money, why should auto workers not go on strike right now and say, okay, prove it, Mr. President, we're on strike
right.
against these layoffs. GM made a decision, it can make another decision. The decision could be to retract this decision to lay people off. Let the workers go on strike and force Trump's hand. This is the tactical moment for workers.
It's a unique opportunity. It's a unique opportunity, and it's very rare for the stars to align like this. You know, we lament on this show all the time the apparent slow death of organized labor. This is a chance to breathe life right back into that movement. So if you've got the president who, through his own words, has put himself into a corner where he's forced to endorse and to support the United Auto Workers Union, well, by God.
Take advantage of it. Prove it. Yeah. You know, Walter, as the clock runs down, when Air France was announcing layoffs, you know, a decade ago, the French workers, the airline workers and other workers went on strike. They shut the country down. And guess what? The Air France decided to retract that decision. This can happen.
And you know what? I bet that public opinion would be in the favor of the GM workers. I mean, here's GM, right? This corporation that just got this massive tax break as a consequence of the pro-rich tax reform that was passed by the Trump administration and the Republican Congress. Here's GM who was bailed out, right, during the economic crisis with public money. And now they want to turn around and ruin the lives of 15,000 people's families just so they can make more profit. I think that there's a growing progressive sentiment in the country, a growing anti-capitalist sentiment, honestly, in the United States. And I bet that there would be tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people who would be willing to mobilize to support, you know, a historic strike like this.
Jackie, the Democrats are denouncing Trump for having made promises not to close factories instead of saying what I'm saying and what John is saying, what Walter is saying. Yeah, if Trump made the promise, make him live up to it right now.
Right.
It's not about politicking for 2020. That's what the Democrats are doing to see if they can get an advantage out of this. We have to stop these layoffs because they're going to destroy families and they're going to destroy whole communities. 15 seconds left.
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem, the weakness with the Democratic Party. This is the great disappointment with the Democratic Party in regard to regular Americans, especially working people, and the labor movement. The Democratic Party has abandoned its supposed roots as the party that supports American workers, that supports working people, and that supports the interests of regular people against the behemoths and the corporatists and the industrialists that take advantage of working people.
That's why the Democrats are not the answer. The Democrats are not the solution. They are, in fact, along with the Republicans, part of the problem. Anyway, we're out of time. That was the voice of Jacqueline Lookman. She is the co-editor-in-chief of the Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every Thursday night at 9 p.m. on Facebook. And we were joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.